Thank you. Thank you very much. Right, so I've been told this is a Madonna mic. I'm not familiar with it. And are you hearing me? Yes, that seems good. Fantastic. I was also told I had to dance. So you've got a choice now. A lecture about the importance of wildlife, or me dancing and singing badly to Madonna songs. And actually, I'm not giving you the choice, just in case you make the wrong one. So the story I'm going to be talking to you about today, my book, The Beauty and the Beast, is remarkably apposite for this festival. Paradise, trying to save paradise. How are you going to do that? And the very first step of the way is falling in love. And that is what this book is all about. It's about falling in love with the natural world. It's about finding a way of reconnecting with nature. And it starts with a quote from a biologist called Stephen Jay Gould. We will not fight to save what we do not love. And for me, this is absolutely at the heart of the work I've been doing as an ecologist for the last 25 or more years. And it's something which I'm going to investigate now. Because what I've done is I've met people a bit like me. I've met ecologists, I've met passionate lovers of the natural world, and had them explain to me and share with me why they think their particular creatures are so important, what lessons we can learn from this. And the reason and the sort of the birthplace of The Beauty and the Beast is the first book I wrote, which is all about hedgehogs, called A Prickly Affair. And in that book, I argued that the hedgehog was the most important creature on the planet. And the fact that between its muddy little paws was held the key to the salvation of humanity. And what I found really surprising was that people began to take issue with this. They began to suggest that I'd lost my marbles, that I was wrong, completely wrong, because their particular creatures were just as important, if not more so. And that's the birthplace of The Beauty and the Beast, is finding people who are a bit like me. I've studied hedgehogs on and off for over 25 years. I know far too much about hedgehogs. And there are people out there who know far too much about everything else too. And what we were doing was working out what is the sort of animal which can act as a gatekeeper species, the sort of animal which can guide you into seeing the world more clearly. And so, very simple, very straightforward, I was restricted to just 15 species by my publishers, and that was going to be the book. But then there was a complication. In November 2009, I decided in that 1 month to grab my midlife crisis and make it my own. And so I decided to do some things I was never, ever, ever going to do again. First time. So I did my first ever stand-up comedy, which was utterly terrifying. I did my first ever dance class. And last, I should say. Utterly terrifying. And I got my first and last tattoo. And I'd been contacted by a band of rather eccentric artists in Manchester who had set up a project called Extinct. Very clever little pun on that. And what they were doing was they were contacting me for information about hedgehogs, sort of obviously, and they're drawing pictures of 100 species from the UK's Biodiversity Action Plan. These are species of the most sort of conservation concern. So they've got 100 species, and they were going to have an exhibition in a gallery which is going to feature information about these species. And perhaps surprisingly, the hedgehog is there on the Biodiversity Action Plan. The population of hedgehogs in this country has fallen conservatively, we know, by 25% in the last 10 years alone. It's possible that the number of hedgehogs in the UK has fallen by over 90% in the last 60 years, but we don't have such rigorous data for that. Something awful's happening out there about hedgehogs. But the unique selling point of this was that there was going to be a tattoo parlor for the opening weekend of the exhibition, and they were going to try and find 100 volunteers to get permanently tattooed with each picture. And so I volunteered for the hedgehog, my first and last tattoo. And I've just come from, I'm actually at another festival as well. I'm going to do a talk at a festival called Shambhala this evening, where I am the least tattooed person present. I've been looking around here trying to find where all the tattoos are, and it's very disappointing. So anyway, that was it. That was very simple. I'd had my midlife crisis, my first and last tattoo, and I was going to write a book looking at these people who've got these passionate relationships with the natural world. And then a number of friends kept saying to me, well, this is surely just a way, an excuse of getting another tattoo, isn't it? This is just your way of dealing that. You're trying to... And they kept saying it so often, I began to think that possibly it was true. And so in the end, I decided to make this serious. I'd make a commitment that the species I was most persuaded by, I would have tattooed to join the hedgehog on my leg. Now, because I'm a scientist at heart, I couldn't just do this entirely subjectively. I needed to inject a degree of objectivity into this. So I developed what is now known as the Rich T Index. And whilst I thought this was a really funny joke, I've since been sent loads of witty pictures of, oh, the Lionel Rich T mugs and the Lionel Rich T face made out of biscuits. It appears I wasn't first. Anyway, the Rich T Index. So what I did after I'd finished my writing up of all my experiences, for each species, I gave a score for researchability, importance, cuteness, helpability, and the quality of time spent with each creature. And fascinatingly, the list which I then generated at the end was not in the order I thought it was going to be. Now, these are the 15 species or groups of species that I went and spent time with. And I'm going to ask you to do something which you should probably feel reasonably comfortable with. I'm going to ask you to talk to your neighbor, just briefly, 30 seconds each. If you were forced to have a tattoo of an animal, which animal would it be and why? I don't want to know now. It's just that if we get some space and time for questions afterwards, it would be quite fun to discover if any of you would have ended up with the same creature I did and for the same reasons. And also, if you've got a dolphin tattoo, I'm going to say now already, I'm really sorry about what's going to happen later. So you've got 30 seconds each. Quickly, which tattoo would you get if you were forced to have one? It doesn't have to be from this list. Okay, that should be plenty of time. Hands up who's got a tattoo of an animal on them. Yes, we have some. Fantastic. We'll come back to you later. Great. So now, there isn't time. Due to the fact I wasn't given the requested three-hour slot to talk that I wanted, to go through all of the species. So we're going to have to skip through a few early on. And I suppose afterwards it wasn't surprising that the invertebrates didn't do so well. Dragonflies are gorgeous. Ingrid Twissell was my dragonfly woman, and I kind of assumed that with a name like that she was going to be wonderfully eccentric. It turned out, within about 15 minutes of meeting, she was looking at me as if I was completely mad. She knows everything there is to know about dragonflies, and they are stunningly beautiful on the wing and hideously ugly under the water. Who's seen any of the Alien films? That is where the alien came from. That is the creature which its model on is the larvae of the dragonfly, even down to the point that the larvae of the dragonfly eats anything and everything that comes close to it, including other dragonfly larvae. It doesn't just have a mouth that opens and grabs things. Its lower jaw shoots out and grabs things and pulls it back. It's terrifying. You imagine life as a minnow in a pond with dragonflies. Anyway, so I didn't quite get dragonflies, despite how beautiful they were. And my moth woman had a really difficult job. Amy Huff, she's been doing an apprenticeship in moths, which just on its own, I think, is a rather delightful thing. Up in Scotland, the BTCV, the British Trust for Conservation Volunteers, have been doing this. You can do apprenticeships in all sorts of wildlife things. And her mentor gave us this place, this site. She'd not been to it. This site is one of the best in Scotland. The weather forecast was perfect. We went up to it, and it was a beautiful mixed environment. And we set up light traps, big, big, bright mercury vapor lamps, and we were sugaring lamp posts here. A mixture of alcohol and sugar, and you smear them on trees, stumps, and posts and things, and it attracts moths. And we went and sat in the car to finish off our Chinese takeaway, which we were having for dinner, and the weather forecast was completely wrong, and the temperature started to plummet. And by the time we came out, it was just about 4 degrees centigrade. Moths will not fly below 4 degrees centigrade. In the entire night, we saw one moth. I see more moths every time I turn the lights on in my bedroom. I was disappointed. Dennis Summers Smith at the bottom is the world's leading expert on house sparrows. And when I met him, I mean, he's published 4 books on sparrows, over 50 scientific papers. And he was talking about how he got into sparrows and how when he was convalescing from a war injury, he was unable to travel very far, and so he started studying the birds that were close to, and these were the sparrows on his house. And I was trying to work out which conflict this would be, because he seemed so sort of sprightly and energetic. Turns out he's over 90, and he was injured on D-Day. And the thing which really threw me was that at the age of 22 or 23, he was in charge of about 50 people, plus armored vehicles. And at that age, what was I doing? Really, nothing which I can even remember. So he was a remarkable man, and the house sparrow is a staggeringly fascinating bird. And it is worth just thinking about that, what it is you can actually study. His passion became that for house sparrows because they were the birds close to. And house sparrows, the most common of birds, their population has, in some urban areas, dropped by over 90% in the last 20 to 30 years. There are some strange and not very nice things happening out there. Chris Sperring at the top is the owl whisperer. He can talk to the owls. And we went off near his Portishead home looking for owls. And what he would do is he assesses owl populations by calling to the owls. And he can speak all the languages of owl. And so we went to this field, and he said, this is a fantastic site for little owls. Now, I can't do the noises. He can. But on my website, you'll see at the end, I've actually got a series of podcasts and includes my time spent with Chris, sort of 10 minutes of it. And on that, you can hear him doing all the owl noises, and it is actually rather impressive. So he did the little owl noise, and nothing happened. And so he went on a bit further. He did the barn owl noise, which sounds remarkably like white noise. The barn owl, you think, what would a bird be going? But apparently that's the noise they make. Nothing happened. Then we saw 3 foxes in the distance in the field. And it was 2 adolescents with probably the mother. And he said, oh, this could be fun. And I'll try this one. This may not be exactly right, but if there are any foxes nearby, it might generate results. He did this, or something like it. Basically kissing the back of his arm. Squeaky noise. The 2 younger foxes just up like this, staring towards where we were. And they ran, both in an arc, until they got to about 10 meters away from us. And then have you ever seen when a cat does something which he's really quite embarrassed about? They said, oh, no, I wasn't. It was amazing. These foxes, both of them at roughly the same point, got to the point where they could see it was people, not an injured rabbit. And they just looked so embarrassed. And then we went looking for tawny owls. And the tawny owls, the tawny owl makes the classic noise. This is what I thought, the tawny owl makes the classic noise. Twit, twoo, obviously. But that's not an owl. That's 2 owls. Thank you. There's somebody down in the front who knows the answer to that one. And the female is going, twit. And the male's going, who? Twit, who? Anyway, so that's when you hear that. So when you've got one of those scenes on a Hammer horror film, and they're trying to give the indication that it's really lonely and sort of there's nobody else around and it's very dark and isolated, and they have twit twoo going on, it's actually there are already 2 owls there. It's not as lonesome as you thought. Adders, oh, they're gorgeous, but you see, the thing about hedgehogs is you can get nose to nose with a hedgehog very, very easily. And of all the species I went to see, this is the one which it was least advised to be doing that with. And Bernard Dawson, who is the adder expert, is the most misanthropic person I have ever met. He keeps a baseball bat by his front door, because sometimes people don't get no for an answer. And he won't open his door for anybody unless you've booked an appointment beforehand. He hates people. He loves adders, dragons, and hardcore speed metal, which was just the strangest. He's retired, and we were wandering around the Holt Lowe's Nature Reserve in North Norfolk looking for adders, and he is a font of knowledge. He adores them, really clever, but just very strange. They are remarkably beautiful. Remarkably beautiful animals, but you don't want to get nose to nose with them. And also, strangely, in the sort of also-rans, the bottlenose dolphin. It's not a dolphin tattoo you've got, is it? Good, good. Now, you see, dolphins are the most charismatic, iconic, beautiful, intelligent, smiley, creative, I know, life-saving, oh my gosh, they're hideous, murdering thugs. And so I was out with Kevin Robinson and the Cetacean Research and Rescue Unit, which is, if you want an awesomely amazing holiday, they take groups of people up on the Moray Firth, and you go and help them with the research, you get an amazing holiday, and you pay slightly more than it costs them to give you board and lodging, and that money keeps the project running. And they've been doing a photo ID survey of the dolphins and the cetacean of the Moray Firth for the last 15 years. An amazing amount of data has been collected, and people, vast numbers of people are needed because you need people to be keeping a lookout as you're traveling along. But, oh, I must just say, I took that picture of urchin. I got to name that dolphin. It's probably about 2 weeks old. It's about that big. It's not been seen since. Now, they started to find harbor porpoises being washed up, dead, having been killed by bottlenose dolphins. Harbor porpoises are about that big. They're very cute. And it was why? Because harbor porpoises and bottlenose dolphins, they don't compete for any resources at all. There is plenty of space in the sea. They don't eat the same food. They don't need the same things. Why were they being killed? And then they started to find young dolphins being washed up with the same injuries. And they now recognize what's happening is that lone male bottlenose dolphins are practicing on harbor porpoises before the reality of taking out baby dolphins. And it's the same as the lions in the Serengeti. A new male will come into the area, and if there's a fight with the resident male of a pride and the new male wins, that male will often kill the cubs. And with the dolphins, it's the same. The female won't come into season for 2 years while she's raising a youngster, but she can be in season within 2 weeks if it dies. So, hideous things. I mean, they're gorgeous, but oh, I know you shouldn't be too anthropomorphic about these things, but really. Anyway, a little bit more time I'll spend on foxes. David MacDonald, Professor David MacDonald is the... He knows more about foxes than anybody else in the world. He's published more papers than anybody else in the world. He runs the Wildlife Conservation and Research Unit at Oxford University. He's Mr. Fox. He knows so much. But what I found fascinating, we met at the Fox Pub just outside Oxford, because that's obviously a good place to meet. And actually, the picture of the fox at the top, that's one of the foxes which was attracted by the noise of the distressed rabbit. And that was taken with a sort of quite a wide-angled lens, so it came really close. But what I found fascinating is the whole thrust of the book and my work is that transition point between knowing lots about something, but also allowing your heart to be engaged as well. And I've give talks to Durrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology, for example, a postgraduate research group, and I got to the point where I was looking at this audience of professors and researchers and I'd say, now I have to introduce the L word. And there was this look of concern. Because they were thinking, well, what is this? We know everything there is to know about statistics, and we've never come across this constant before, and what is the L? And then when I said what it was, it was like this, oh my God, we've let in a hippie! Because it fascinates me that even David MacDonald, who is just so hardcore academic, he is still motivated by something more than just the numbers. And I kept prodding him, trying to get him to say the L word. He wouldn't. He kept using appreciation as a byline. But what I did love about our time together was a comment he gave me towards the end of our conversation. It's a mistake to think that things retain their magic better if they aren't understood. And this is something which I've got a lot of friends who go, why do you want to know what sort of bird that is or what sort of butterfly that is? Can't you just accept it for its loveliness and its gorgeousness and its beauty? And often they're quite frightened that if you learn tons of stuff about something, then somehow the glamour goes. And I really disagree with that. The more I've learned about hedgehogs, the more I've fallen in love. Beavers,
They're extinct, or they were, 400 years ago. That was when they were wiped out. They got the most fantastic coat. Hence the reason why they were hunted into extinction. Now, beavers are fantastic as well for maintaining a rich biodiversity, wetland biodiversity. And Paul Ramsey has an estate up in Scotland, and he was at a meeting with conservationists, and they were saying, well, we must improve the biodiversity. He'd been trying to flood some of his bits of land. He'd built a little dam with some rubble, and he'd been trying to make it wetter to get more trees growing, and it was going fine. And one of the people in the audience said, well, of course, it'd be much easier if we had some beavers in the environment. And he thought that was a fantastic idea. But then Scottish Natural Heritage had meetings, and then they had discussion groups, and then they had reports, and then more meetings and discussion. And he just thought, I'm going to get some. So he hired a white van, and he drove down to Kent and picked two up from immigration headquarters or whatever it was. I mean, sneaking across the border, trying to find an easy life in the UK, and released them onto his estate. Now, there's this thing you would think. You'd think that over the thousands, millions of years of evolution which has gone into creating the beautiful thing that is a beaver whose main aim in life is to do what they do in the cartoons. That was fascinating. They actually do the stuff. They do the chopping around the tree and the tree falls over. You would think over the millions of years of beaver evolution, they would have worked out which way the tree was going to fall. Anyway. He found one of his females wasn't so bright at it and had to get some more. But now he's got a flourishing population of beavers on his land, and they are transforming it. And it is a fantastic and fascinating time. I presume monkeys, when they're swinging through the trees, must occasionally miss and fall, but I suppose you just don't find them. It just seems a bit sad. Okay, so I can go. Now, Kate Long is a water vole expert, and I had been wanting to find a water vole expert. I've been wanting to find more women because a lot of the most obvious eccentrics that I met were male. And then I spend a lot of time surfing really quite strange sort of notice boards and discussion boards on the internet. And there was one which was, there was a piece, it was a photograph of a water vole, and it was signed off by the vole woman. I thought, this is good, the vole woman. I've got to find who the vole woman is. I found that she kept a blog, Stags Brook blog, and this was blog heaven. Pictures of water voles, pictures of water vole trackways, pictures of water vole feeding stations, pictures of water vole food, pictures of water vole poo. Lots of pictures of water vole poo. And this has been going on, she's been doing it for years. And this woman is amazing. She's just obsessed with water voles. But there's no connection, no way of getting into contact with her. Until eventually I managed to track down a reference to a Kate Long who had been doing some water vole work in the same part of the world, searched for her, found the same photograph on Kate Long's website. Turns out she's a best-selling author of what is disparagingly called chick lit, but she calls commercial women's fiction. And she wrote The Bad Mother's Handbook, which my wife had just finished. And she's just, her latest book called Before She Was Mine, she's introduced a character a bit like her, and she's now opened up her two sides of her life to each other. Now people recognize that she is the mad water vole woman, and she is wonderful. But we had this conversation. She had the most absolute clear-cut Damascene moment of any of my fellow animal lovers. She was traveling down, age about 8, down to the West Country on holiday, and got to a car park. She thinks it was Krukern. She wasn't entirely sure. And Mummy said, we must go buy some food. And she said, okay, got out of the car, crossing over a small bridge. And as she crossed over the bridge, she saw a little water vole sitting in the water doing what they do. And just pop back into the water. Come back out. She was transfixed, utterly transfixed. And her mum said, right, we've got to go and get the food. And she's 8 years old. She said, no, I'm not going. And so they had a discussion. I don't quite know how long the discussion lasted. And she said, now, yeah, looking back on it, it was the 1970s, and everyone was a bit more trusting. And her mum said, okay. And as she said, my mother cautioned me against falling into the water. But what happened was more profound. I fell in love. And this has stayed with her entire time. It was nearly an hour her mum was gone. Just stood there, fascinated by it, and she spent the rest of the time. We ended up going out, sticking the small stools down in the brook, it turned out, because it had flooded and she didn't know. If you ever do meet up with Kate Long and she says, let's go and see the water voles, and she said, no, you won't need your Wellington boots. Take them. And we did. We stuck the stools down. And the reeds around you gently rustling in the wind. And you've got the noise of the trickling stream. And slowly everything just... And that's one of the reasons why she does it. She tells her friends, because they keep asking her, they say, so you go there to think about ideas for your books. And she's now ended up lying and saying yes, because they just don't understand that she goes there not to think. And just to... It is a beautiful space. And very fortunate. There will be a brook near you, possibly if you're lucky, which has got water voles. Go and try. It's worth it. Now the bees are good. Bumblebees. I thought bumblebees would be a great option. And I met a man at an allotment open day with a bumblebee on his hand. And he beckoned to us to come over. And my daughter, she was about 7 at the time, quite timid, would you like to stroke a bumblebee? She stroked the furry, quivering body of a bumblebee. And then he said, would you want to have it walk on? She said, walk onto your hand. And he could sense that hesitation. I mean, how many generations have we known you never touch and play with stripy insects because they're all evil? And he said, no, it's fine. Let it walk onto your hand. It can't sting you. It's a male. Only females sting you. He told me the way to tell the difference between a male and a female bumblebee. There's about 20 species, and roughly it's the same in each. Unfortunately, I've now forgotten. But it's also a little spot on their forehead, just there. It's a bit like that thing where an elephant charges you. If its trunk's up, it's a fake charge. Or is it when its trunk is down? Anyway. But it was an amazing sensation to feel a bumblebee walk onto your hand. Something so small, so fragile, like an impossibly sort of furry mouse. It's so light. It doesn't weigh anything, but it's there. And it's buzz. And I was saying, well, this is fantastic. Bumblebees, they're amazing. Everybody's worried about honeybees. Bumblebees, let's talk about the bumblebees. He said, oh, bumblebee, shmumblebee. Let's look at the important bees. Solitary bees. You see, there's one species of honeybee, 20 species of bumblebee, 220 species of solitary bee, which, as their name suggests, don't live in big communities. They're all over the place, and they are largely ignored. You will see them, you think that's a bit of a funny bee or a funny wasp or something. It's not quite right, but I don't know, I'll not pay any attention to it. And they come in all shapes and sizes as the bees go. And they live in holes in the ground or in holes in bits of mortar or in holes in trees. And you'll find little holes in the ground like that. That's a bee emerging from its nest. So we went out and we did traditional entomological things. We went to ornithological things with butterfly nets. And we just, he's registered blind, Ivan, my bee man. And every swipe, he did that. He'd catch some impossibly small, bright jewel of bee. I missed every single time. But anyway, he showed me them, we talked our way through them. They are a remarkable creature because they are so much better at pollinating than honeybees. Yet we've domesticated honeybees. Honeybees are a massively abused creature. But these bees are the ones that keep our world full of flowers and life. And these are the ones who are having their homes destroyed. 97% of the wildflower meadows since the end of the Second World War have been destroyed. I heard a figure a couple of weeks ago, somebody saying it's now 98% of the wild. You'd think by now, we might have got to grips with this one, but no. They are a remarkable species. And one of the highest bits of praise I've ever had for my book was a friend of mine came up to me after he'd read it and he said, I've just taken the family up into the place where you saw the solitary bees and we went looking for solitary bees. You know what? We found them. And it's the first time we'd ever seen them. Go looking for those holes in the ground and find yourself some solitary bees. Now my Robin man, Andrew Lack, this is a bit of a trick question. I should have said, what species do you think it is? There he is. This is just an indication of his qualities. Irritating guy, this. There he is playing the Lark Ascending. He's the leader of the ISIS Chamber Orchestra, and he's written the new Naturalist Guide to Pollination, Bird Guides to Dominica. But most significantly, I think, is he's written this beautiful book called Redbreast,
Well, he's rewritten. His father wrote the original version of it. It's about the poetry, the folklore, the mythology of robins. And it's a gorgeous book. Though he did begin by pointing out it's a misnomer, because if you look at a robin, and if you can persuade a robin to stand next to a, you know, swat sheet or something like that from B&Q, it's actually got an orange breast. I mean, it just probably didn't sound as good. Anyway, so the red breast, full of this mythology. And this bird is a bird which we like no other species. In fact, the robin likes us. And it behaves in a tame way, unlike anywhere else in its entire range across Europe. Throughout Europe, it's persecuted. Like all the songbirds of southern Europe, they're blasted for fun or for snacks. Or they're lured in with songs and calls, and they get stuck on the glued branches of people's trees. And then plucked and eaten. He's talked about how the relationship we have with robins is partly because we garden in a very different way to most places. We are out there, we're doing the digging and things like that. And the reason that is so significant is because we are, as far as the robin concerned, we are two-legged pigs in their natural habitat. Do you see, the robin is much smaller than a blackbird, but they eat similar sorts of food. The robin can't have a massive battle with an earthworm. It's too small. It'll get pulled back in, and that wouldn't work. So what it does in its natural environment is wait behind the wild pigs as they grub up the ground. And it'll wait just on, about fork stuck in the ground size, height, and then just dive down and pick up the grubs as they're exposed. We are nothing but pigs to robins. But it does mean they come close to us, and it means they have become associated with so many different aspects of life. And perhaps remarkably, they are so closely associated with death that throughout the mythology and folklore of Robin, this runs through so many times. And you can actually begin to work out why. During the winter, before the days of good food storage and central heating, that's when people would tend to die. During the winter, when there are no leaves on the trees, there's only one bird singing. The robin sings all year long, pretty much. And it's the most obvious bird as well. So it's out there and it's singing. It's probably true that the last bird that person who's just died heard singing was a robin. Not because of anything spooky, but because it was the only one there. But it has this association. And what is the thing you'll do when somebody has died? You'll throw open the windows, either, releasing spirits or freshening the air. And robins are tame and they will fly in to buildings and pick up crumbs of spilt food. So this association between robins and death continues. Even to now, there was Libby Purvis, who is the presenter of Midweek on Radio 4. When the day her son died, he killed himself after a long fight with depression. The day her son died, a robin flew into a window and broke its wing, and they brought it into the house. And it was, unfortunately, it died. She had no idea of the association with robins. And after his book was published posthumously, he wrote a book all about his depression. And when the books arrived, they were placed in a big pile in the living room, and a robin flew into the room and perched on the stack of books. It's the first time a robin had ever flown into their house. And it wouldn't be shooed away at all. And she was, it was such a powerful and moving thing. And I was on Midweek too, and we were talking about it. It's just so intimately linked, this bird. And the thing which I loved about what Andrew said when we were talking was this. Scientists do themselves a disservice if they deny the importance of the unquantifiable, because there's stuff going on out there. Yet again, you see another scientist who's kind of swerving around the word, the L word. We'll get there in the end. This was a bit of a cheat because everybody loves otters. I mean, they are rather cute. And Miriam Darlington, she's just published a wonderful, wonderful book called Otter Country, about her experiences with otters. She had a moment with otters, again as a child, reading Ring of Bright Water and Tarka the Otter. And she just invested everything into becoming an otter. She wanted to be an otter. And as a poet, she writes beautifully, like an otter swims, just that sinuous way through the medium. And we had such a wonderful time. This is Sammy the Otter. It was actually in a sanctuary because it was too tame to be released into the wild. We went looking for wild otters on the River Dart down near her home in Totnes. And we found, she took me to a cave. We had to go. I was getting quite excited. I thought we'd get otter watching in the pub. She took me to a pub. We're going to go and find some otters, she said. And we walked past, through the pub, out through the kitchen, down some steps and across a muddy bit of ground to a cave underneath the bank. And we started to go into the cave, and there's some otter footprints, beautifully preserved otter footprints.
The thing is, because they're nocturnal and they're secretive, you just don't get to see otters. So footprints are a really good thing. But she said, I'm really hoping we can find some poo. Now, spraint, it's got its own name. Otter poo is called spraint. And spraint is very significant because most people who study otters study otter spraint because you don't see the animal. Otter spraint tells you what it's eating. It tells you where the otter is. It can even give an indication in which way it's moving. She said, it's important we find some because I really want you to smell it. Now, up until recently, the skunk was considered to be in the same family, order of family, the mustelids. The skunk has now been moved into its own little bit of taxonomic sidelining, but they're very closely related. And I had heard this story before from otter experts. It smells wonderful. You really got to get a good sniff of otter poo. And I've been wondering, is it like one of those sort of induction ceremonies you do for people? And you tell them it's wonderful, and they take this great big sniff, and then you go, you really thought that was true? Anyway, we didn't find any, which is a great disappointment. But about 2 weeks later, I got a little parcel through the post. And you're ahead of me on this one, aren't you? And inside the plastic envelope, there was a small jewelry box, beautiful little jewelry box, on the picture. It was a little cartoon drawing of an otter with sniff me underneath it. Then inside the box, there was lots of cotton wool, and inside the cotton wool, there was a small plastic bag. And I was just thinking, is this a joke? There's no cameras. I'll do it. So I did, as she said. I took a big sniff. Never, ever take a deep, big sniff of a small bag full of dry otter poo, because it'll zoom up your nose. After I finished sneezing, I tried again. It's better fresh, apparently. And the thing is, it's wonderful. Jasmine, hints of jasmine, bit of mown, hay, bit of tea, small bit of fish, little bit of fish. And it was the most wonderful. I was so thrilled. And my midlife crisis all went wrong because I continued dancing. And so I took it to my dance class. I said, this is brilliant. You've got to try this. It's a very strange dance form I do. Ecstatic five rhythms dancing. And full of very strange people. Very, very strange people. And it's the first time ever I think I'd out-trumped them on strangeness. And now what you've got to do is work out, am I joining in on the conspiracy? What does otter poo really smell like? Okay, bats nearly won. I so nearly wanted, I really wanted bats to win because I thought it would look really cool. And Hummer Pierce, who in the red hat there, she is, I believe, those of you can see, she's got a Batman tattoo. She's got a bracelet of Batman tattoos around her wrist. I first met her at a Mammal Society conference. She drinks an awful lot of coffee and is really small and spends her time on the tips of her toes bouncing around to go, oh, this is so good. And she took me out into central London. We went bat detecting in central London. And it was amazing. Chiswick Park and Gardens. We saw two different species of bat. Right, we could hear, I think, three motorways and a major A road. And we're right near Heathrow flight path. We could still pick up bats. They are everywhere. They are remarkable. They're beautiful. But still, all I was seeing was silhouettes and hearing the translated squeaks through the bat detector. Because the bats are communicating at a frequency beyond which we can hear. And the little machine we had slows it down a bit, so maybe we can actually make sense of it. And she said, well, that's all right. I'll introduce you to some bats. And she took me to meet this other one, Jenny Clark. Jenny Clark is like a 1950s TV chef, I think. And she speaks with a precision. She even holds a bat with a cocked finger as if it was a fine china cup of tea. And every word is spoken precisely. And she adores, you can see, she adores bats. She's brilliantly camp. And she has a bunch of education bats, the bats that she couldn't release into the wild from the Sussex Bat Hospital that she runs. And she keeps them in big sort of vivariums. I ask my gentleman friends for their old trousers, especially corduroys, because
she hangs these in the cages, and the bats roost inside the trouser leg. So she's rummaging up some old gentleman's trouser leg and pulled out a series of bats. We're showing the bats. If I'd been allowed to stroke them, I think I might have been won over by the bat. And in the end, she pulled out, at the bottom she's holding, the brown, long-eared bat. As you can tell, it's named by somebody unimaginative. But the thing is, it was asleep. Now, when the brown, long-eared bat is asleep, its ears are flopped forwards over its face. And it's very... And it's sleepily, as it woke up, it was like a time-lapse photography of a flower opening, the petals opening, and its ears just lifted up. And it was blinking in the relative bright light. And it's got freckles on its nose. And it was just... It was so tempting to go for that as a tattoo. And I was advised before I went to see Homer, if someone were to bomb the National Bat Conference, Britain would be in danger of losing its reputation as a hotbed of eccentricity. Now, what I have to say, though, having now met a whole series of people like Homer, like me, it's not just the Bat Conference which would be a danger to our wonderful reputation. And so now what we can do is come to the winner. I wonder if anybody's got there. Actually, it's quite good doing this in long trousers. I've been doing a lot of talks recently. It's been hot, and I've been wearing shorts, and it's kind of a giveaway. The winner is the toad, the common toad. And my toad man, Gordon McClellan, he runs an environmental education organization called Creeping Toad. I've known him for years. I remember him getting his first ever tattoo of a toad on his arm just here. And I remember quite disparaging saying, I thought you were going to get that coloured in. And he looked at me and said, I'm never, ever having another tattoo. However, he has now got an entire rainforest scene growing up over his shoulder. And as you can see from the other photograph, on his right leg, he's got a coral reef scene. On his left leg, he's got a Paleolithic woodland scene as well. And he's aiming for, I think, the full body thing when eventually he's earned enough money. And his love of toads is something very deep and very different. Yes, he has a bucket and a luminous jacket in the back of his car so that whenever he comes across a bunch of toads on their mating journey, he can rescue them from the middle of the road. Because toads, if you build a road in between where toads like to hang out and where toads like to reproduce, they're just going to go across the road. And there are patches around the country where you will have cataclysmic death to toads unless you get these people. And sometimes they'll put up signs and they will have a permission. They will stop the traffic, scooping up toads and moving them. His connection with the toad, though, goes beyond that. He is a shaman and he has a trance world which is, at its heart, got a toad. I've known him for a long time. We've spent many nights getting very drunk as he's tried to explain again and again what on earth he's talking about. I still don't get it. But I was telling him about my quest, about this journey, about me wanting to find out more about these things, about finding people's connections. Why is it that people fall in love with some animals? How can this help us appreciate and love the world the more? And he said, well, why didn't you come and join me? Now, he doesn't lick toads or take drugs. He dances into a trance. Now, I've been doing weird stuff, so I thought, you know what? Okay, I'll do it. So he invited me to a shamanic dancing retreat up in Derbyshire in January. That's significant. You see, I thought we'd be dancing indoors. The blades of grass had frozen into individual needles. It was mind-numbingly cold, and as I saw him putting thermal underwear on underneath his big shamanic-y robes, I realized I was underdressed. And so I went back, got out the car, everything I brought with me. It may just be me, but personally I think it's difficult to dance into a transcendental state while wearing tweed. And so that experience kind of passed me by, but I was still interested, because what I'm interested in is the connection. How can we have these points of connection with an animal? Most of the animals we've seen, dolphins you're not really going to get that close to, and you can throw breadcrumbs to the sparrows. Admittedly, you can tame robins to come and feed from your hand. That's quite good. Obviously, adders are out of the question. But I was camping in the New Forest with some friends, and one of the other kids
first thing in the morning, he'd got up and he'd put on his dad's Wellington boots. You know, kids will put on dad's Wellington boots. They come up to here and they walk around and they think it's very funny. He sat down with us. We were chatting. And suddenly he went, and this toad had been hiding in the toe of the boot. And it was a really good job. It was the kid that put the boot on. And the toad crawled up his leg out to freedom. Well, actually not freedom, because I grabbed hold of him. And we all were looking at him. The toad is a remarkable creature. The toad has got jewels for eyes. Its eyes are like little golden nuggets of amber. And they are riddled with stories of transformation and things. They are a remarkable creature. And we ended up just realizing that this is the closest creature you're going to get to the hedgehog in terms of ability to get close to it. But also, it's got so many stories attached to it, so many ways of leading people into understanding it. You can get close to it, but it is magical and fascinating in its own right. And so in the end, the toad was what won it. And so I completed my commitment and got my second and last tattoo of a toad. My wife certainly hoped so. And actually, that normally would be the end of things. However, I've skipped over one of the characters and one of the species because I wanted to give him some special attention. Very recently, I was very sad to find that my badger man, Gareth Morgan, had died. And he was out looking for ospreys, doing his favorite thing. And he was a good friend, and it was such a shock. It's only the second talk I've done since he's died, so if I start blubbing, I'm really sorry. I went to his funeral, and it was just one of those moments of finding all of these people, sort of 300 people at the funeral, who had been touched by him and been out with him looking for badgers. And what he was showing me with the badgers was captured really by this statement. You know, we've got to fall in love with nature. It's all we've got. And your badgers and your hedgehogs, my badgers and your hedgehogs, they're like gatekeepers to the wider wonder of the natural world. And it was something he managed to do for so many people. He'd tamed a set of badgers. He kept the position of the set fairly secret, and the badgers would come, and they would come close, and you'd have a chance to interact with a genuinely wild animal. And he told me the stories of them, which made, he was angry. Bovine tuberculosis. He was really raging about that. Bovine tuberculosis, they're going to start killing badgers again if they get a chance, because badgers are a wildlife reservoir of this disease, which affects the dairy industry's bottom line. But the disease is called bovine tuberculosis for a good reason. It's a cattle disease. The cattle gave it to the badgers in the first place, not the beavers. And he gets mad about that, and the way that farmers are maintaining the land and how poorly managed it is. And then he was crying as he was remembering the badgers of his that had died, and he was so passionate about that. And then he was laughing. He is the only man who can say the word copulating in a way which will make you giggle, because his lovely rolling Welsh accent captures it perfectly. And it's on the website, urchin.info. You can listen to him talk about his absolutely beloved creatures. And so that is it. I've done it. I've ended up with my second and last tattoo. I would love to know if any of you are now going to consider to go off and get yourself one of these animals tattooed in your body. Be very happy to offer you a good tattooist up in Huddersfield. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. And now we've got some time, I think. I haven't got a clock to hand. We've got some time for questions until I'm thrown off. And at 12:30, I'm going to be in the bookstore signing copies of The Beauty and the Beast. And also, I went down there and was very gratified to see they've got my hedgehog book in there as well. So if you don't want to ask questions in a crowd, come and ask questions down in the bookshop at 12:30, and I will do my best to answer whatever I can. But for now, if there's anybody got any questions, shout. Oh, have we got the mic? Yes. Okay. But if otherwise, just shout. Project. Or leave. Come on, there must be some questions. Ah, sorry, thank you, yes. Are we good? Do you want to wait for the mics? I can't.
You mentioned some sort of research thing. Do you need to have a background in research?
Sorry, do I have a background in research?
Does one need to have one to go to that thing you mentioned, for like the research thingy?
Sorry, which thing?
Oh, the dolphin thing. Sorry, yeah. I missed the word. No, absolutely not. What they need is eyes. They need people who can not be sick and stand on a boat, a rigid inflatable boat, bounce around the Moray Firth for 6 to 8 hours, wearing full immersion gear, which I turned up with my barber jacket, waterproof trousers and wellies, and they laughed at me. Wellington boots are a bad idea on a boat, I've since discovered. You die in Wellington boots. They fill with water and drag you down to the bottom. And then you have to, lots of talcum powder. But hey, it's worth it. It's Cetacean Research and Rescue Unit. And they operate during the summer up in the Moray Firth and then in Thailand in the winter. And the guy who runs it, Kevin, is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Yes.
Just a comment to say that on the subject of Cretaceans, we were sailing out Santander this summer, and I don't know if they're there all the time, but the top deck of the boat, the Pont Avant, the Brittany ferries, was flooded with people watching for whales and dolphins. I presume they do it a lot of the time.
The Bay of Biscay route is fantastic for it, absolutely fantastic, and it's a really great way of doing a cetacean watch, sort of on the cheap. If you find the right place, it is apparently wonderful. Did you get to see much? Oh, yes. Yes, up at the back. And then up at the back as well. Could we have somebody down at the front first just to make him run a bit more? That'd be great. Yeah.
What are your three favourite things about hedgehogs?
The three favourite things? Okay, do you want the 2.5-hour version of that one? The fact that you can get nose-to-nose with hedgehogs. You can get really close to them. And you can get a glimpse of wildness in their eyes, it's basically just the one thing wrapping up lots of others. You can get close to loads of other different creatures, but they don't either have character, particularly, you know, one worm is much like another worm. But the hedgehog, I've studied them for so long, they have individual characters. So they've got an individual character, you can get close to them, and when you look into their eyes, you see something wild, genuinely wild, yet accessible. And it's a very special thing to do. I really recommend going and lying down with some hedgehogs. It's worthwhile. Just up at the top as well, please.
Whereabouts?
Just up there. Okay, somewhere down here next, please. That'd be good.
When did you first fall in love with hedgehogs?
That's a good question. I was studying them for quite a while first as an ecologist, and there is my one moment. It's a hedgehog called Nigel. I was already in trouble because I'd given all my hedgehogs names. I was radio tracking them in Devon, and my supervisor was, you don't give them names, they've got numbers, perfectly good numbers. But he was in Surrey, and I was living in a caravan in Devon. And I was out one night with Nigel. Well, not with Nigel, I suppose. We went out clubbing together. Not something you can say to a seal, they get offended with that one. But about 4 o'clock in the morning, I was coming out of my caravan to clean my teeth, and I saw a hedgehog just waiting beside the caravan, and I left all my radio tracking gear behind, and I just followed him. And I followed him down a small, narrow lane, and the further we got, I could get closer and closer and closer, and I could see him feeding along the grassy side of the verge. And realizing on those small lanes, it's why hedgehogs get killed on even the quietest roads. There was less than one car an hour along there through the middle of the night. Yet, there was nowhere for the hedgehog to go, and it would be the first car and the last car often those hedgehogs would meet on that stretch. So that's why they were at such risk. But ended up, I was getting so close, I lay down on the road and was just watching him, and he turned and started looking at me. And that was the moment of change for me. It was also possibly I've been living alone for a long time in a caravan without much sleep, but it was that moment of just realizing that this hedgehog was aware enough, clever enough, to be able to clock me as a presence that wasn't a threat, and then it just carried on eating. And it was that moment of going, okay, this is something special. This is why hedgehogs are so special. But thank you for that. It's a good question.
I've been an amateur ornithologist for most of my since my teens. I've had various passions about various birds at particular times of my life. And it just getting close to individual species and studying them even for a short period of time, you suddenly think, this is interesting, you know. I became involved in looking for more hen nests. I was surprised at one place to find more hens nesting in trees. Now, that creates a problem for more hens because they've got to look after the young once the young leave the nest. But it just struck me that it's about loving things. And, you know, a loving nature, there's so much in the Bible about the love and the joy. And actually just watching something and enjoying something is actually a prayer in itself.
I find the sense of... Well, there's some friends of mine, Buddhist friends of mine, they talk about mindfulness, which for me is the best way of describing it, is that losing yourself, immersing yourself in the natural world. And I do find that each of these little species you spend time with can act like a lens through which you can see so much else better. I mean, William Blake did it kind of neatly with poetry, seeing heaven in a wild flower and the universe in a grain of sand. It's that sort of thing. If you spend some time, even with the most mundane things, house sparrows, you can learn so much from spending time with them.
Yeah, do we know what's happening to hedgehogs? Because these encounters, which I used to have fairly regularly, it's just not happening.
Okay, that's really interesting. I've done hundreds of talks with the Women's Institute, and what I found there was regularly I was being asked the question, why are we seeing fewer hedgehogs? And to begin with, I did wonder whether it was one of those nostalgic views of the world, you know, summers were nicer, food tasted better, teenagers were politer, and we saw more hedgehogs. But we've been running an unfortunate survey called Mammals on Roads for quite some time now. I work with the British Hedgehog Preservation Society and the People's Trust for Endangered Species. Mammals on Roads. People drive certain journeys repeatedly, year after year, counting the number of dead things they see and recording them. And the more dead hedgehogs you see, the better. Oh, that's so wrong, but it is. So we've been doing these surveys, and these surveys have been plotting a downward decline, and now we've got the best ecological statisticians in the country to go through our data and give us this figure, conservatively 25% decline in 10 years, possibly much, much more, definitely much, much more. Why? That's another lecture, but in short, habitat loss and habitat fragmentation are the two big things. And it's not just you lose a patch of ground, it's the fact that the loss of that patch of ground splits up the remaining good bits. The most obvious thing is you've got a lovely population of hedgehogs here, and you put a big road through it, and so you've got two populations of hedgehogs. And you put another road through it, you've got four populations of hedgehogs. And then you put some houses here with fences which hedgehogs can't get through, and suddenly you've got small pockets of hedgehogs, which can't move and can't interbreed and can't escape. And so when one dies, there are possibly no young to take its place. This is happening on a massive scale across the country. So we've launched a project called Hedgehog Street. And it's hedgehogstreet.org, I think, is the website. And from that, it's basically talking about getting people to talk to their neighbors, because suburbia is the last sort of stronghold of the hedgehogs. In fact, Countryfile on the 2nd of... So it must be next Sunday, 2nd of September. I'll be on there talking all about Hedgehog Street. So you can have a look at that. But yes, it is the splitting up of the countryside. Yes, your question.
Have you seen your tattoo?
No, it's all right. I feel like a rock star. I'll put my foot on the speaker at the front. So the hedgehog is here. I had to consider the Women's Institute when I was getting my tattoos done and realized that if I had it put on my torso, I would have to reveal more than is good for them. So we have a hedgehog on my leg here. And on the other side, we have, my toad. Actually, if you join me in the bookshop, I will show you. You can get a closer look. Have a photograph of yourself taken with my tattoos. People will be queuing for that one for ages. Okay, one more, just over there, I think. But then please do come to the bookshop if you've got more questions.
My question's a bit of a downer, so I was hoping it wouldn't be the last one. But you spoke quite beautifully about the kind of the beauty and, I guess, the sweetness of nature. But there's also the kind of inescapable kind of... There's kind of a violence and a cruelty to nature as well, you know, the insects who lay eggs and other insects. And you've talked about the dolphins and duck reproductive kind of habits and that type of stuff. And I just wonder how do we fall in love with that? Because I'd like to, but it seems difficult to me.
But you fall in love with nature. You fall in love by getting close to an animal. You fall in love by, you know, looking into the wild eyes of a hedgehog or into the golden glittering jewels of the eyes of a toad. You find something special. And there are people out there. I mean, yesterday, my wife took a photograph of me with the biggest scorpion I've ever seen walking up my arm. And the person who owned that scorpion was just going, oh, but she's beautiful and I love her. And I go, this is a bloody great scorpion on my arm. People will find different ways of loving. They'll find different animals, different species. The reason why the hedgehog is so important, that was a big miss. The reason the hedgehog is so important is because of the opportunity you get, I think. And a lot of the big conservation and wildlife groups will use the charismatic megafauna, elephants and whales and dolphins and tigers, to try and sell a love of the natural world. And because we do, yeah, everyone recognizes, we will not fight to save what we do not love. But it's a bit like relying on Heat magazine and Hello magazine for informing our ideas of human relationships. Pictures of A-list celebrities, you know, the charismatic megafauna of the human world. You're going to end up falling in love with the boy or the girl next door. And for me, the hedgehog is the animal equivalent of the boy or the girl next door. But for other people, they're going to fall in love with somebody else. And so, yes, the scorpion does some pretty horrible things with the ding, 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 spikes and stuff. Yuck. Other people hate hedgehogs because they think they're covered in fleas. They're not. And other people don't, you know, they don't like toads because they're yucky and witches, I don't know, cook them or something. Yeah, all of these things, people have their own ways of doing it. And yes, nature, fantastically complicated. But so are we, and we still fall in love with people. Okay. Anyway, thank you very much for remaining, and see you all soon.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. You don't forget, you'll be signing in the bookstore straight after this, isn't it? Half past 12 in bookstore for Hugh's signing.